Blog Talk Radio.
Time now for Lydia's Literary Lowdown on Greater Good Ministries Radio. Join Lydia at 4 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Eastern every Saturday and get the lowdown on today's popular authors, publishers, and pundits. Lydia's Literary Lowdown, right here on GGM Radio, every Saturday, 4 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Eastern.
Welcome to Lydia's Literary Lowdown. I am so happy to have Eric Cobb Miller on the show today. So happy indeed that I'm not even going to let the poor man talk, at least not initially. There's a lot of talk that goes around about voice. You'll hear literary agents, editors, publishers, aspiring authors, self-pub, traditional, it doesn't matter. They talk about voice. And I'm going to start off this show telling you why you should read Eric Cobb Miller by his voice. So here goes. This is from Spittoon Saloon, Rinse and Spittoon Proprietors, Sad Songs and Funny Tales on Tap. I think you can tell. I think you're all clairvoyant or have enough premonition that I'm going to tell you to buy this book to read it. Here is why. This is a paragraph in the book. Flashing is the name of the title. Alas, the acceptance letters never came, although the rejection slips inundated my mailbox. It disappointed me, to be sure, but the comments about my punctuation just outright enraged me. Editors constantly criticized how I used my colon, as if that were any of their concern. Moreover, they claimed that my semicolons were acting like squatters in places they didn't belong. As for my commas, they described them as looking like insects randomly stuck between the teeth of a motorcyclist without a face shield, even going so far as to label me a comma splicer. One especially unhappy editor, who thought she was Portia in The Merchant of Venice, told me that my quotation marks droppeth not as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath, but as sleet wrapped irritatingly around the wrong words. That's all I'm going to read. That's one paragraph in this book. One paragraph. And it is so chock full of voice that I had to interview you, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lydia. A pleasure.
You know, this is a situation where just describing you, I love your description, which is you're no longer swimming upstream in saliva. You were a dentist.
Yes, I was.
One of the things you talk about in the book is that in between waiting for this and that to harden and sucking out spit and doing, you know, swimming in that saliva, you started to think there was more to the world out there. Is this where you came up with your tales?
Yes. As I said in the book, you know, I like to think of myself and other people characterize me as being a big picture guy. So there I am looking in that small aperture of a mouth that I keep saying open wider, and it's this black, dark, wet hole. And it was just totally different than the image and dream I had of where I wanted to be and go.
Right. And I mean, obviously you're an indie author, but this is a book I cannot stress. I have to say, it's your first book. It's not the only book you have. You have three books.
Yes.
I've been privileged enough to read The Sad Songs and Funny Tales on Tap and Overheard at the Bar at Spittoon Saloon. But you also have a third book out as well, Toast from the Tap at Spittoon Saloon.
Yes.
Here's the amazing bit. Okay, so my poor listeners have heard, or my enlightened now listeners have heard, what great voice you have. You also illustrate.
No, I don't illustrate.
You aren't illustrating all of these?
No, I had to subcontract that. I do not have enough talent to illustrate.
Well, I have to tell you, what you come up with, if you don't follow Eric on Twitter, you need to. It's at Spittoons Saloon. And, of course, you can also find him. You have a blog, and that's Spittoons Saloon at blogspot.com. You can literally just probably Google you and find you everywhere.
Yeah, it's scary when you type your name in and you see how many things come up.
Yeah, but it's a good thing. I mean, I don't think it can be anything other than a good thing for you. Now, obviously, we know you're a dentist, but did you start, I always like to ask if you started writing, doodling, anything like that whenever you were young, or was it reading that really got you into writing eventually?
Well, it was a three-step thing. My parents were both my parents were voracious readers. You know, our house was filled with lined bookshelves of all the classics, etc. So I was reading at an early age and prolifically. My parents were both into, you know, words. My mother would play, you know, Scrabble and all these other word games with me. So I was always in, and they also took me to, you know, lots of movies and plays. And so, you know, I became, that was my focus. And but it wasn't until my junior year in high school that it all came together. And as you know from having read the book, I was in an English class. The English teacher was my next-door neighbor, and he was the chairman of the public high school English department. And he was a character. He was like a Mr. Chips. And he told our class on the first day, you know, we were all friends, we all knew each other, that this is what he had planned for us. And he said, we're going to do some Shakespeare, but, you know, that's not going to be the primary thing. We have to do that. But what we're going to do is each one of you, before the end of class today, is going to go to the library, go to the card catalog. Nobody knows that term anymore. And you're going to choose an American author, and each one of you will choose a different American author. You will read all of the major works of that author and be that author in class every day for the academic year. And I ended up as F. Scott Fitzgerald, and by the end of that year, I knew that I wanted to be a writer.
And did you start then? Or did you start cobbling together your own work?
Well, no, I mean, I was always writing, but I didn't really write a lot of stories, per se, really, until I retired. I wrote columns for newspapers and, you know, journals and things like that. But I didn't really do a lot of creative writing until after I retired. I kept saying, when I retire, that's what I'm going to do.
And that's the lovely bit. I mean, we're for writers, because, you know, this show is for and about writers and everyone in the wonderful wide world of publishing. What really struck me and why you should buy this book, I'm not a big flogger of books. I love reading them. One of the privileges that I get is to read all the books of the people that I interview. But I'm going to tell you to buy this book. Now, admittedly, I am playing favorites. But the reason why is because if you invest in the first book, it's a small investment that will literally just, I mean, I'm a rereader. I'm a compulsive rereader. Before we came on air, I was literally quoting things back to Eric about his book. I would recommend Sad Songs and Funny Tales on Tap first. Why? If you're a writer, if you heard what I read, Eric has been there. He's been there. He knows all about rejections. He's been there. And I think you are able to reach and kind of get to the other side of rejection, because there are stages of rejection. There's the, you know, the moping, I can't believe they did that, my heart is broken. You handle it with a lot of levity. Is that just natural to you, or did it take a lot of rejections for you to get to that point where you could be, well, hilarious about it? There's no better way to put it.
No, I was always, I always had that mindset. I mean, my parents instilled that in me, and so that's how I learned to survive at an early age.
Right, and the other thing is, there are so many things that happen in this book. It is really about your life, but it is the essence of a literary humorist. It just really is. You know, the names, your dental assistant, Saliva Godiva, I'm telling you. That's not all. That's just one of many names. I love your therapist, Dr. Lion Couch, right?
Yes.
I just think the names that you came up with, they add to the experience. But you do something else that I told you before we went on air. Sad Songs and Funny Tales on Tap is literally what I call a magic trick. Magic trick of a novel. That is, you think it's going in one direction, and then right at the very end, it switches direction with a rapidity. And it really, I'm not even sure how I can describe this. I like books that don't throw morals at you. I like books that are entertaining and breezy, but they make you think as well. And that's exactly what Eric accomplishes in just the last pages of this book. Literally, I think it is the last page, because I brought it up to him. And it's just a couple of lines, and it brings it through to you that all along there's been a thread running through this of seriousness, of lessons learned as time goes by. So honestly, I'm of the opinion I wish you would have started writing sooner, but I suppose you were swimming upstream in saliva.
Yeah, wishing to get out of the mouth and into the world.
Right, and my big question is, because I adore this book so much, are you planning on working on others where you do a story sort of format, talk more about your life? Because I'm going to tell you right now, as a reader, I want more. That's it.
Yes, I am.
Which is fabulous. And I'm not going to demand release dates or anything. However, I will stalk you on Twitter. You have been warned.
You've been doing that for 3 years, Lydia. I'm used to it.
It's very true. And did you aim? Because so many times voice is just voice. It's the way you speak. It's the way, I call voice the essence of your soul distilled into words. That's my definition. Well, you have quite a soul just based on what you've written here. And some of these events, I have to wonder, I would love to go through this and just grill you on so many different things that I wonder, and I wonder if you meant for this to be or not, I wonder if are true. Do you know what I mean? There's mention of a fire, and there's a mystery associated with that particular fire. And the way that you write it, I'm not certain whether or not this is a true happening or not. I lean on the side of it being true. And quite frankly, I just want to read more. I want to find out more about it. But is that, just my curiosity, is that actually something that happened? Are a great deal of the incidents, if you will, hilarious incidents, and some very poignant, are they true in this book?
Actually, that's the most frequent question I get from readers. And as I wrote it, and when I finished reading it and I read it, I realized that it was much truer than I really planned on it being. And in fact, and I always have to, I'm always a little shy on the, a little unsure of the percentage, but I estimate that 95% of it is absolute truth. Only the names have been changed.
I mean, that again, I love supporting indie authors. But you need to read this book if most of that is true, and that's why I'm hectoring you on air to get you on air agreeing that you are going to write in this manner again. There's just too much that I want to know as the reader, and yet one gets the feeling that you wanted to entertain. And also, you're a double threat, aren't you? Because you're not just writing about many incidents in your life and making me wet myself with laughter. Yes, it happened, but people, I'm 40. You have to expect the breakdown of certain systems. You're also a poet.
Well, I did start writing, it was really just limericks and doggerel when I was in junior high school. And that was just basically to entertain the good-looking young lasses that would sit, in front of me, behind me, and on either side of my desk. And so I never was big on poetry until when I retired and I started writing. I started with short stories, and I would submit, and I learned about flash fiction for the first time. What do I do with these stories? Because I have a natural inclination to do these short, pithy kind of creations, and I learned about flash fiction. And that was the first thing I started doing. After over a year and a half or so, I had really written a lot of stuff. And somewhere along the line, I just started to do some poems. And then I realized that some of my poems actually were poetic versions of prose stories I could write, or my, or vice versa. So a lot of the poetry and the stories, have gone back and forth in both formats before they ended up where they are.
And they're brilliant. I mean, I look through, and the lovely bit about this is it's almost a two-for-one. I mean, that's what I think about it, is I was eager to read your story because it is an intriguing story. You have done so many things. You've been so many places. You're a Vietnam veteran. You've lived in New York, and then you and your wife moved to the Philadelphia area. You're a writer. You're a poet. You've done flash fiction. You've been a dentist. You talk about your experience with Vietnam, and as a dentist as well, and you do it in ways, I just think it's a thrilling new perspective that I don't think people think of. Because you're a dentist, and I don't know about you, well, you're going to have a different perspective than me, but when I hear someone's a dentist, my eyes tend to drift closed of their own accord.
Well, that, no, yet, that's absolutely true. That's true.
And you're the most lively, you know, you put an entirely different perspective on the Vietnam War just based on your service there, and yet there was some pathos buried in there. Is that something you mean? You know, I always love process. I love your process to find out what it is, because mine may be very different. And it's so fascinating to see if you meant for that pathos to be there, or it just kind of exposed itself as you wrote.
Well, I knew that when I was going to be writing about Vietnam, I started out by, you know, focusing on the funny experiences I had, my MASH-like experience. But as I wrote, I realized that there were other things I wanted to say, and I knew that that was when I really realized that the book that I was originally conceived as being, you know, light, breezy, and totally humorous was going to have some very serious stuff in it along the way.
But you did it in such a palatable way. I mean, it is funny. It is something. I think humor, I think anyone who is a literary humorist does us all a favor, because I'm not one for great emotion. Do you know what I mean? In a book, you can safely feel that emotion, but I prefer to laugh. If you can open someone's heart by making them laugh, you're going to get a great deal more smuggled in of what you have to say than you would if you just straight out told a horrific experience that you had there. Both work, but I think yours is the more, well, palatable. I really do. And F. Scott Fitzgerald was obviously an influence. Were there any other influences of yours?
Well, I mean, the Mark Twain type of people, definitely had an effect on me. But the humor, which, I don't think it just was there. I think it was my parents force-fed me and drew it out somehow, and then it took hold. Because, I mean, they would drag me to Broadway shows, you know, comedic, you know, musical, heavy drama. But they also did all the comedy clubs back then. And so, I would be tagging along for years, you know, seeing the Shelley Bermans and the Mort Sauls and the Alan Kings and the Rodney Dangerfields. And, I mean, you know, I really got into a rhythm. You know, even the supper clubs, you know, with Ben Stiller's parents, Stiller and Muir and Nichols and May and all this kind of stuff. And we would hear that at home on records. And so there was a point when I knew that humor was the edge I had, you know. And but it took many years and a lifetime of living to realize how to use it appropriately. A funny story is that, you know, I did a lot of lecturing in the course of my career, and there's nothing more horrendous than a dentist lecturing, you know, clinically and very dry and straight. And I used to hate sitting through those kind of lectures in dentistry or other venues. And there came a time when, you know, some friends of mine and I would go to various, you know, events where there would be speakers, and we were listening, and a lot of these people, you know, are compulsive note takers, and I'm not a note taker, but whenever they saw me taking notes, they would think, my God, there's something really important, he's taking the notes. But all I was writing down was the humor lines that the people were using, so that I could use that as a guideline on how to, you know, interject, assimilate, you know, humor into what I was doing, whether it was dry didactic lecturing or whether it was talking about something serious, you know, from a literary perspective. But it took a lifetime of living. And, you know, I could not have written this book if I hadn't lived my life. I mean, I could not have come up with this, you know, when I was young in college or whatever, even though I thought I might have been able to.
Well, you never know, because the one thing that a lot of people, this may be harsh, but I think I've never come up across it, so I'm not certain that it's true. But there are some people in the publishing world who opine that you either have voice or you don't. You can. There are some who are so dead set against it, they say, well, it's not something you can develop. And I think your opinion, at least as I understand it, my opinion is yours, is that you can develop it. It's
yes,
no more
yes.
than developing who you are. But I have to say, I think you're being too humble. Your voice is too well established, and I'll be interviewing someone who just tweeted. It was 140 characters, but she packed them with voice. That's what caught my eye about you, is that you pack every tweet with voice. It's there. And once you see it, you can't kind of unsee it. You want to read more of that person's work, but it's who you are. I mean, every word that you write, the rhythm that you have, that's who you are. And have you found, because you're an indie author, so you went kind of the self-publishing route. Have you found that to really fit your needs?
Well, I've been happy with the indie route, and I think it's got great potential. You know, I still dream of having an agent. You and I were talking earlier about voice, and we were discussing a little poem I have in the book about voice and a platform. And I remember before I really knew that I was going indie and I was looking for an agent, one prominent agent responded very positively to my query email because, you know, he heard my voice.
Right.
I don't even think I really knew what a voice was at that point, per se, in the literary, you know, definition. And so he wanted to see more. And then he wrote back and said he was so disappointed because I didn't have the voice that he thought he had heard.
But it was there.
In the email, but it was there in the email, and that's why I wrote that little poem, because I was so frustrated. That was probably one of the most frustrating events in my, as I was evolving, was to have this guy so excited that he heard a voice and then told me I didn't have a voice.
Yeah, it's really difficult, and that's something every writer goes through. I mean, rejection, unless you're going a self-publishing route, and quite honestly, most of the indie authors I know, they have great editors, they have great support teams. I have read your book. I obviously adore your book. You edited, or you had people look at this. It is in wonderful condition. There's nothing I can fault. I can't. I have absolutely, I'm on Goodreads, so I've absolutely, you get a 5-star, and some of the more traditional agented authors might not always receive that. I think I'm glad to see more of an acceptance of indie authors. I like even the term better than self-publishing. I think indie just has a bit more, legitimacy? I know that sounds awful.
Well, it's a popular word
now.
What
do we do? We're writers.
Well, with filmmakers, too. I mean, look at all the independent filmmakers and cable television and independent networks. You know what I mean? It's the wave of the future.
It is. And I mean, you know, I think people are looking towards that. You know, I almost always bring up 50 Shades of Grey. I'm sure you perused it breathlessly with sweat running down your brow. Not. I don't actually believe that. But I'll take sad songs and funny tales on tap any day.
I did a book signing at a local bookstore in our area, and the topic of that book came up, and the owner of the store had taken it off the shelves because he just thought it was so terrible, and he had it in the bathroom.
He left it there
in the
amazing
bathroom for people to read or use.
And that's one of those things where, are you actually intending, I just get curious in that whenever you refer to another agent, you say that as if you would be prepared to accept representation, but are you doing any querying? Or are you sticking to what you've done? Because
I've been very consistent and happy with what I've been doing over the last 3 years. I really see no reason to change, but I also realize that you always have the urge you want to try and just see if you can hook somebody.
You know, you may not have to. I mean, this is a situation where increasingly, I hate to use this particular book, but back to 50 Shades of Grey, which I've never read, full disclosure. That said, my upcoming guest this next week is M.B. Freeman. She has a book, I mean, I love her book as well, but it's popping with voice like yours. And you know what? She didn't look for an agent either. She went the indie route herself, and an agent happened to read one of her friends, or someone she knew, a mutual acquaintance, read her book, got in touch with an agent, was friends with an agent. That's how she got representation. I look at what you've written, and I think I just don't see how this couldn't go out there, because it's not, you know, the other beautiful thing about indie is that you can have a book like Sad Songs and Funny Tales on Tap where you've got poetry. It's two for one. You have this lovely poetry, and then you also have this life story, and it's anything but dull. It's exciting. You want to read more. That, to me, I mean, I can understand your frustration, because that, to me, is if you want to read more, then someone's going to pick up on this. Someone's going to see this. They're going to see that it's wonderful. And now, how involved are you involved from step one to the end? Do other people have any say? I know the beautiful thing also is the picture, the cover art on Sad Songs and Funny Tales on Tap. I know the story behind it. Our audience doesn't. Could you enlighten them as to that picture?
My father was a dentist also, but he was a very Renaissance man. So he was across the board interested and talented in all various forms of culture. So he was an artist, and he painted a lot of paintings, many of which were not good, but he made a number that were very good. And I remember I was a sophomore in college coming home for a Thanksgiving vacation, and I walked into the house, and that painting was leaning against the wall in a corner, and I said, "What's that?" And he said, "Oh, something I did." And I said, "That's your best painting." And he says, "I don't like it." And I said, "Well, I do." And he said, "Well, it's yours. And it's been with me wherever I've been for my whole life, hanging on a wall." And when it came time for a book cover, I looked at that painting and I knew that was the cover I wanted.
It's perfect. I mean, it's perfect. It gives you everything. I mean, I'm not a sucker for cover art. Most of the time I'm too busy reading the description. But in this particular case, it really caught my attention. And it fits with the book. It really does
fit with everything you've been saying, yes.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's an inspired, it really is inspired. How do you choose? Like, you have two other books, you know, on Overheard at the Bar or Toast from the Tap at Spittoon Saloon. How do you manage, go through all these wonderful images and quotes you come up with and pick one? Isn't that incredibly difficult? It would be for me.
I mean, well, of all these quotes, just, you know, they just are rattling around in my head, so they just keep coming out. And then it's difficult to sift through them all and find out which ones are better than others and which are right to be used. But you're right about the toast, even though that's a simple book, because all the toasts had basically been written before the book was put together. There were a lot of toasts. So, and then it was just trying to get the right ones in and not leave the right ones out. And
they're amazing, though. I mean, it just the time. I would love to plagiarize freely. I really would. But as you can see, I've stuck. See, Eric is very original. What he has down, you're just not going to find anywhere else. And he tweets these regularly. But owning them, I look at them and I just wish. I wish that I could use them, but I'm too dull. I'll have to start quoting you every now and again, but then I'm afraid I'll tweet, and you've tweeted the same thing, and then we're at cross purposes.
Yeah,
that would be a wee bit, untidy, wouldn't it? Now, one thing I'm going to save until after the break, because this is right at the beginning of the book. You're probably asked this in every single interview, but I want to know where the spit comes in, and if it is in fact what it's portrayed in the book. 95% true, you say, so we're going to find out after the break. Join me right back here on Lydia's Literary Lowdown, which I'm tripping over the literary, but we'll get there. Join me right back here in a few minutes to speak with Eric Cobb Miller.
Hello, everyone. B. Delosier here with a rundown of GGM Radio's brand new schedule. Boy, have we got some wonderful new programs with great new hosts. A little something for everyone. On Mondays at 11 a.m. Central, it's Messages of Light with Amanda Dowell for an hour of psychic chat and inspirational guests. Mondays at 7 p.m. Central, it's time for Primarily Paranormal with psychic Tina Marie. Share an hour with Tina and Bob Weber of Gulf Coast Paranormal. On the second and fourth Tuesday of every month at 8 p.m. Central, it's the Back to Brilliance Hour with Lynn Hoft and Vivian Hildebrand, an hour devoted to your spiritual growth. Wednesdays start at 11 a.m. Central with Maggie Holbeck and Crystal Clear Coaching, featuring motivational inspiration to get your life back on track. At 1 p.m. Central, join Claudia Cleary on Wednesdays with Namaste Nutrition for an hour of soothing chat all about good health, positivity, and spiritual balance. Thursdays, start your day at 9 a.m. Central with Nancy Murdoch and Mastering the Art of Joyfulness. let Nancy and her special guests lift you out of that rut and get you back in your groove. At 8 p.m. Central, join Dr. Gregory Scott for the Light Giver Universal Healer Hour. Gregory offers spiritual education to further you along your path to enlightenment and empowerment. Fridays at 12 noon Central, it's Alive to Thrive with Brenda Fraser. Join Brenda for an hour of inspiration and motivation, featuring a lineup of today's most popular authors and guests. Friday night at 7 p.m. Central, enjoy an hour of psychic chat with spot-on reader Tasha Harris and the Angels Network. Saturdays begin at noon Central with Bea Delosier, yours truly, and the Metaphysical Edge for psychic chat and interesting guests ranging from UFO research, paranormal experiencers, and all things metaphysical. At 2 p.m. Central on Saturday, it's Audrey Quinn and My Beauty Angel, an hour created just for you with tips and tricks on how to be the best you can be with what God has given you. Sunday is a day of service here on Greater Good Ministries Radio, each week featuring a different interfaith minister, bringing joy, upliftment, and unfoldment for body, mind, and spirit. The first Sunday of the month is Conversations Beyond the Edge with Dr. Gregory Scott. The second Sunday of the month is the Empowerment Hour with Reverend Barbara B. Delosier. Third Sunday of the month is the Light Givers International Sunday Service and Worldwide Source a Nation Celebration. The fourth Sunday of the month is In His Presence with Evangelist Patricia Benneman. Hope you will join us live for all of our Greater Good Ministries radio programs. But if you can't be with us in person, you can hear any of our programs on demand in archives at www.blogtalkradio.com/ggmradio. And remember, all of our programs now stream live from our home site, www.ggmradio.com. Wishing everyone warmest blessings, always in love, light, and sound. Music provided by Arvel Bird, musician extraordinaire. Visit him at arvelbird.com and get a hold of all of Arvel's wonderful music.
Welcome back to Lydia's Literary Lowdown. I am here with Eric Cobb Miller, the terrific author of a book that you must purchase. And you know I don't say this all the time. I'm not a hard sell. But you really need to invest in that first book. The other two are great. Don't get me wrong. But I am just absolutely stuck, mad with love for Sad Songs and Funny Tales on Tap. Now, right in the beginning, whenever you open this page, we've heard that you can find Eric at Spittoon Saloon on Twitter, and you can, and you should absolutely follow him because he has great stuff, great quotes. He's also at spittoonsaloon.blogspot.com. You should go there. You should even check out Amazon or Barnes & Noble where you can buy his books. But there is one thing, since I have known Eric, that I want to know, and it's right here in his book. Call me Spit, it says. Everyone does, except my mother, who still calls me Salvatore. I like to think of myself as a big, bright picture kind of guy, but Salvatore Spitel Tune DMD. My daily view of life is the small, dark, wet, malodorous, confined spaces of oral cavities. I read that whole thing not because I needed to, but because I wanted to. It's another brilliant demonstration of voice, Eric. You're just going to have to be indulgent with me. Is it true that spit is any form of Eric Cobb Miller?
Spit is the spitting image of Eric Cobb Miller.
Really?
Yes.
And this is where that 95% true, I'm telling you, you would not regret getting this book because there are more bombshells like this. The only thing that I have to say is, like, Dr. Lion Couch or Saliva Godiva or Rinse, which I love. I love the names that you have in these, but they cannot be true. If they are, though, please.
These are real people, but they have normal names.
The names are amazing. They're absolutely amazing. And you know what? One thing I haven't asked you yet is, isn't your family tremendously proud of your work? Because I would be. The way that you put this down. Some families, you know, it's kind of dreaming the impossible dream. I know that's where my family is right now. I don't like to reference myself, but I will say, you know, I'm working on my fifth year just trying to get an agent. And they're like, yeah, that's great. Sing it again, Lydia. Go ahead, sing it again. But in your case, this is just such a fabulous book, and it mentions everyone you care about in the best way possible. And you don't just, I mean, you know, there's literary humor, and then there's also the threads that run underneath that show who you are, define who you are as a person. And if we are to read this, not only were you an excellent soldier, an excellent clinician, an excellent dentist, and I will pronounce excellent right at some point, but also a wonderful father, grandfather. There are so, and your parents are in here, everything you could want, and yet it's all wrapped in a neat, tidy little bow to make you laugh and make you think afterwards. Because the truth of the matter was, after I read this, after I read the entire thing, it's a quick read because it's so good, I had to go back to page 168, to just those two sentences. And audience, you're going to have to read them yourself, but they will hit you in the gut in the best of ways. And you will see this is a magic trick of a novel. The whole time, you've been fed, you've been entertained, you've been enjoying this gourmet meal as opposed to a cracker or a pickle for your dinner. And at the end, boom, there's dessert. But it is, it's just very touching, I think. And you deserve credit for that. As I said, I did warn Eric beforehand. And the audience needs to know, the more I love a book, the more I'm going to gush about it. So, Eric, you're just going to have to take it like a man, I'm afraid.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, yeah, and that was a very good Elvis impression, by the way. But your family has always supported this. I always ask because it's very different. Some people stay almost in the closet, if you will, with their writing. In fact, I was advised once to stay in the closet because it takes so long. What's the point in telling anyone? But was your family actively reading the manuscript as you came along with it, mixing this or approving that?
I didn't share the manuscript with many people. My wife, of course, read it as it would evolve. She has three sisters, and whenever we would see them, they would read portions of it, or they would read it that, you know, it evolved over time. But very few people really know what I'm doing until they see the book.
Well, I think I should be included in that number of people who can see, who are allowed to see. But you got sufficient encouragement the whole way, and were they kind of, did you get to the point where you shared rejections with them when you were kind of on the agent hunt, or did you always keep that to yourself? Because that varies as well.
No. I shared it greatly. I like you've already characterized, I packaged it in a humorous context and self-deprecating, and would make good stories out of it, and would get a lot of laughter at dinner parties, etc.
Oh, no doubt. Now, when you were a voracious reader growing up, are you still a book a night or a book or two a week kind of person? And what do you like to read in your downtime? What kind of genres do you like to read?
Actually, my genres have, you know, the niche has, you know, narrowed. And so I just read basically, you know, literary fiction. I don't read as many books as I used to. I still read the newspaper a lot. You know, I'm a big New York Times addict. And so if I can't get through a New York Times every day, you know, I feel like I'm a failure. So.
But do you do the crossword in pen?
Well, you know, that's interesting. When I went to Vietnam, I said I was going to learn how to do two things. I was going to learn how to play bridge and how to do the crossword. I didn't learn either one.
No, well, yeah, but you would make a better stab of it than I would. I have no doubt of that.
I became a great poker player and a great pool player in Vietnam rather than the other.
And so I assume your next stunning debut, if you will, of the next series, because this is a trilogy. Are we going to get, is it a series? Or is it a trilogy? Are you starting, turning over a new leaf with your next book? Or is
I still have a dilemma on that. I'm in love with the handle Spittoon Saloon, and so are the people who know about it. So I may end up with some kind of reference to Spittoon Saloon on the cover of whatever I write. But
well, you kind of have to. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's just too fascinating not to. But I would, of course, you know, if you ask me for a suggestion and you haven't, let that be duly noted. You've got to write more about your life.
Because I have an open, implicit acknowledgement that I want anything you have to offer.
Well, no, that you can reverse that. Turn that around and back it up, because I'm going to be the one on you to read more of your work. And, you know, again, you will notice, you know, I do like to gush because I like to read. I will read 3 or 4 books a week, if not more. Sometimes I'm reading, I have to juggle books between my Kindle. And is that something you have, or are you into the whole kind of digital, or are you like me? I'm halfway. I love my paper books. I love the paperback.
No, I still like the paperback book. I still like to have a real newspaper in my hand.
I'll never get used to. I'll never get used to, and I won't read. I have magazines waiting for me right now. I will not read those, even though I can get a tablet edition. I like to have my hands on that paper.
Yeah, we have the New Yorker magazine, so, you know, we like to spend a lot of time reading all the stuff in the New Yorker.
Right, and you know, one thing, though, is I always ask every single author what their process is like. Like, you're sitting down, you know you're going to be writing. I don't know if you schedule it. Do you schedule your writing, or do you kind of, whenever the mood hits you, do you go ahead and write?
No, I'm pretty disciplined. I get up early, and I'm a morning person, so I do my best work when I first get up.
Yeah, good for you, buddy. I'm not. I'm allergic to mornings. You know it. You've seen me tweet it. I don't like mornings. And do you, whenever you're sitting down, you're disciplined about it, do you need music? Do you need total silence? Do you like to have the TV on the background? I don't know why, but this fascinates me. It does.
I need total silence. I need to work in a tomb.
And that helps you concentrate?
Yeah, that's the only way I can concentrate. Even when I studied in college, I'd have to find some dark, you know, corner of the stacks in the library where I couldn't hear anything.
Wow. Yeah. You know what? I'm going to say, I need the silence, but I have to have the music to create the silence because I have offspring, which is the nice thing about having your offspring and being retired is that you can get that time. But have you ever had, you know, you're disciplined and you get up first thing in the morning. Do you ever stay up nights kind of writing prose in your head? I do it all the time. It drives me crazy.
Oh, yeah, I do.
It interferes with my sleep.
That's why I'm so good in the morning, because I've been dreaming and thinking of it all night.
Does it drive you? Do you ever keep a notebook handy? I have notebooks everywhere. I'll make notes in them, and then I can't find the right notebook.
Well, my problem is I'll have something there and I'll scribble something down, but then I can't read it in the morning.
Yeah. The glasses, they're a beautiful thing. Our magnifying glasses, I'm getting closer to that. That's interesting in that because, like, specifically Sad Songs and Funny Tales is about your life. It's kind of a linear direction. So when I hear that you kind of write down on scraps of paper, is that a direction? You know, a lot of people ask if you're a plotter or a panster. I was a panster with my first novel because I knew exactly where it was going. I knew everything. But then with the second, I have to sit down and outline. Do you do that whenever a lot of these stories are about what you've experienced?
Traditionally, I realize I'm going to have to do that more in the future, but traditionally I follow where the story takes me. So I start writing and I need to get traction. And so I'll start over and over again. And once I get started, then I start writing. But
I have a big picture in my mind, but usually I don't know where the story's going to go. Even though it's my life or whatever, I don't know how I'm going to handle it. So I just let my fingers tap away, and I'm pleasantly surprised or appalled.
Yes, well, you know, but that brings us to revision. Do you have to do a lot of it? Because I swear you make it look so natural on the page.
I do a lot of revision. That's why I have a lot of scrap paper, because I get these ideas of how I'm going to approach something, and or I think of a phrase or a wordplay that I want to use, and I have to scribble that somewhere so I don't forget it.
Well, that is one thing that you excel at. I mean, your sentences have me, I'm not drooling on air, but I kind of look at it. I just open the book to a random place. Well, that's a good question, he replied. Can one actually pronounce pithy in a lispist form? That's one sentence, randomly, out of the book. And you excel at things that make me envy you mightily. Because it looks effortless. So to hear that you have to revise, you just kind of know what, you know, I kind of look at you as when you revise, you already know what you want to say. You're polishing. That's all you're doing.
Well, yeah. No, as you were just speaking, I was thinking I maybe have misled you. I don't revise per se, but I polish. You're right.
Yeah, and it's just brilliant. And, you know, it's a situation where I always wonder, because you have a couple of really amusing. First of all, when you're babysitting your grandchildren, oh, those are beautiful. You don't have to have grandchildren to appreciate that at all. But, you know, it goes, I'm no nuclear scientist, so I haven't had any experience with nuclear energy. However, I do have lots of experience with nuclear and energy. That's what I call my two grandsons. So, what did they think kind of your portrayal? I think it's hilarious. I have five sons. I think it's spot on, just the description. Did they get a laugh out of that?
Well, when I first conjured up that idea, they were a little on the young side. I mean, they laughed a little bit, but now that they're a little bit older, they ask me about it again. They don't seem to have a problem with it. They smile. I think they like the fact that they have this special, something that's special about them, you know, that's being used. They love seeing the books. I mean, they're constantly looking at the book and reading through it. And, of course, they, you know, each year they get a little more sophisticated in their reading. But I told them they wouldn't get the true essence of the book until they were much older.
Yeah, but you know what? I mean, that brings us to sophistication. What is your thought? Like, a lot of people, I suppose when I think of sophistication, my definition would be, we were talking while the commercial played about, I like Dickens. I think Dickens has a really great sense of humor, but he's so long-winded. But on the other hand, I love Hemingway. I love Shakespeare. I think of those as sophisticated. Some people think it's like Dante's Seven Circles of Hell, Nine Circles of Hell. I obviously haven't read it. And I think it sounds like a little bit of a downer, like the opposite of said Songs and Funny Tales on Tap. I'm not into that. But what's your idea of sophistication?
Well, I like to think that what I do is sophisticated, though a lot of people don't get it, or they just think it's low-grade humor. And but I think it's classic literary humor.
I would argue. I mean, I'm almost arguing with you, and you wrote this stuff. I mean, how is this not sophisticated? I don't, you know, that's not something, I didn't think anyone could level that charge at you and hope to be believed, because Mark Twain, a literary humorist, and yet he's not always, I think there is a problem almost there.
Our program is being brought to you by ShotNet Web Hosting, reliable web hosting for everyone. Feature rich, reliable, and affordable. Create your own site in minutes with ShotNet's easy-to-use site designer. Monthly plans available that fit any budget. Visit shot-net.com. That's shot-net.com. Cultivate your spirituality with visionary practices of a higher nature in your own home and at your own pace. Empower You Metaphysical Academy, Yusui Reiki, Amadeus Shamanic Healing, Karuna Reiki, Celtic Reiki, and many more energy attunements and modalities available. Learn in the privacy of your own home.
Eric, did I hear you?
Yes.
Yes. I dropped off the air because, you know, that wasn't actually a practical joke. It's just a sign of my acumen in producing a show.
Oh.
And
I was confused. I didn't know whether that was the automatic end that you had referred to.
Right. I tried to prepare everyone that it's just automatically going to end. It cuts everyone off. Well, this time it cut me off. I hope that's not some sort of kind of Skynet Terminator sign that perhaps I shouldn't be hosting a show at all. But we. But you know, the interesting thing is that for those grandsons we were discussing before I got kicked off air, I'm sure you laid an egg or two for them. In honor of Easter, you know. Yeah, because I did. And my children are a bit old for the whole Easter thing, at least for the Easter egg hunt. But there's a bio waiting for them. I can tell you that. I'm so sorry about that. We were talking about your grandsons. We were talking about how, and also sophistication in writing, because I tend to lose focus when I'm unceremoniously booted off the air and my poor guest is left hanging. So which was it? Were we talking about sophistication?
We were talking about sophistication, and
yeah,
you know,
Twain.
Well, one of the problems I think what I do is sophisticated, and I realize that you know, because it is sophisticated to a certain degree, that's why a lot of people don't get it or don't connect with it.
Well, yeah, but that would mean I'm intelligent, and I refuse to believe such drivel. I really don't, because I don't think, hearing the samples that I've read today on air, because they're joyful, they're hilarious, they're easily digestible, and yet they are sophisticated because they pull, I think anything that can pull emotions from you, that can trick you in a way, in the best of ways, which is make you, after you read it, think a little deeper. Think about what you've read. Go back and read those lines again. I think that's a mark of an excellent writer. I've done it. I mean, not with my own work. That would never happen. But I don't think your work is, I don't think it's inaccessible. I think there is a stigma on excellent voices like yours that says, well, that's literary humorous. Does that term sound too sophisticated to handle for some people? Because I think literary fiction, nowadays, people refer to it like it's reading something that's dreaming the impossible dream that you'll ever get through it. But would you agree? Sorry, I kind of dribbled.
No, I do agree. And it's interesting, going back to some things you said earlier, when the book first came out, you know, I shared it with a number of people, you know, I had known my whole lifetime. Their reaction was very interesting in the fact that they recognized the tales, you know, as being true, even though it's couched in the manner it is. And then I shared it with some of our neighbors, whom we've only known for a few years, and so they know nothing about us for all intents and purposes. And the reaction was, you know, very varied. There were people who got it just like you did, and there were others who didn't have a clue. So,
I have to wonder if that, it reminds me of a woman much my elder who I would bring my magazines. I subscribe to an inordinate amount because I live in fear of not having something to read. I really do. It's sad. There should be some sort of phobia named after that. That's my phobia, fear of not having something to read. And I remember bringing in a load of magazines and a book or two, and she flipped through the magazines while I sat down and started reading from the cover to the end. Oh, I never read them. I just look at the picture, she said. And I looked at her in total astonishment. I think that's some of the problem that we confront today. And sometimes, you know, that's why less than stellar work is released at times in traditional publishing. And indie as well, I'm sure.
That's true. No, that's true. Absolutely.
No, I don't think, I mean, I can't imagine, having read it and then even reread Sad Songs and Funny Tunes on Tap, I don't think you can mistake this for being true. there's a thread that runs underneath that's identifiable. If you like to read, if you like to be amused and yet learn something at the same time, I mean, it really is something that is also, I think that's more mainstream. I think literary humorist is the thing that will throw people off, like literary fiction, because nowadays, we, you know, think of like Cormac McCarthy's The Road, a big,
right,
depressing novel. I think some people associate literary humorist with the literary fiction, and it's not true. Remember, a humorist is there to make you laugh, but to make you think. Mark Twain always did. Eric Cobb Miller does.
Thank you.
And he does it brilliantly. And you need to read the book because it's not something that you see every day. I think that's why sometimes people won't get it.
Well, like we started the conversation an hour ago, you really do get it, and I am very appreciative for that.
Well, that's the whole point, isn't it? I mean, I think that's what every author hopes to accomplish, and that is someone who can live, breathe, and kind of understand everything that I think writing is an extension of yourself. You know, those of us who are self, is deprecative a word? I don't think it is, but I like making up words. I don't think I'm alone there because I spotted a few in Sad Songs and Funny Tales on Tap. But I think people who are the most, a lot of writers are, that they are self-deprecating, and I think that hides the inside. I think some of the best authors hide what's really inside from everyone, including the words that they use, and yet it always escapes. That message, who they are, it always escapes. And
well,
so
and writing the book, you know, in the form of a spitting image is a way of attempting to have some distance.
Right, and the way that you phrase, I mean, you sneak up on the reader, and I love
right.
that. I mean, I'm always looking, because I've read so much, there's nothing more irritating than reading a book, and I name names, because you can see it on my Goodreads. I can't hide. But I recently read War Brides, which was a very well-recommended book, and I thought it was a good book. Don't get me wrong. It was utterly predictable. I knew what was going to happen. I knew what was going to happen in the first places. That doesn't mean the author didn't do a good job. But what you've done here is you've surprised me. I didn't expect that last page to resonate the way that it did. I didn't expect the poetry, which sometimes is almost at odds with what you've said in a humorous way on the page opposite.
You get it. You get it. It's amazing.
Well, that's it. But that's the point. It is amazing. And the whole point of Lydia's Literary Lowdown is to bring out people like you and say, hey, this man has a voice. He has something to say. It's worth listening to. Because you're not getting the experience I had with War Brides. I knew what was going to happen. And it was a good experience, but I would say it was like eating a peanut butter and jelly sandwich for dinner when I really wanted a 9-course meal. War Brides is a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Sad Songs and Funny Tales on Tap is a 9-course gourmet meal. That's it.
Oh, Lydia, I love you.
Well, yeah,
I'll only be dreaming of you tonight, not my next book.
Well, yeah, well, there's no point in, you know, no. It's just truth. That's what I like. That's what I like about your book. It's truth. It's just the way it is. And you have a very good way of kind of portraying that truth where we can absorb it, yet you don't do it in a commercial fashion. Nowadays, readers are stupid. Do you know? And I don't mean that sincerely, because I know readers are anything but stupid. Readers are very intelligent, and I think sometimes they're pandered to. They're treated with your 50 Shades of Grey, and some people will argue Twilight, some of the things that are coming up. But what we see from that is now the evolution where we have the smarter books coming out, like yours, like The Hunger Games, for instance, because I'm in a totally different genre from what you write. But it's time for literary humor to come back and to not be feared, like almost literary fiction is not too dense or awful to get through. But I think that's literary humor. If you can be the spokesman in this generation, I would like you to be. So just go ahead, take my vote. You've been voted in, and now you have to represent that. Get on a podium, deliver a speech. We'll drop balloons at the end and maybe some confetti if you're lucky, if the budget holds.
Well, you put the pressure on me, kiddo, I'll tell
well,
you.
Well, yeah, well, but yeah, I know you can live up to it. I wouldn't put such pressure down.
You have motivated me. It's not a burden at all.
Well,
you have energized me.
Excellent. Well, and thank you so much for appearing, because we're actually in a final seconds here. Thank you so much for appearing.
Thank you very much, Lydia. I'm very grateful.
Oh, well, so am I. You just come out with more work, and then I'll be that much more grateful. Now, next week, I have to tell you that MD Freeman is going to join us. By day, her mind's filled with medical jargon at the local health clinic, but at night, she finds herself exploring alternate worlds within our own. Her award-winning debut novel, Incandescent, we'll be talking about that, as well as Illumination, the next book in the series. In the meantime, I will see you all next week. And remember that voice really is the essence of your soul distilled into words. Thanks all. Have a great week.